welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. And today I'm excited to bring on Dr. Darian Parker and his book, SART and No Child Left Behind, an existential psychoanalytic anthropology of urban schooling, Lexington Books, 2015. Dr. Parker, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'm excited. I want to tell my audience that, you know, the book's title is long, and you might think, oh, I don't know if I can grasp this, but you make it quite clear, familiar narratives as we get into it, and you explain some of this theories and these philosophical outlooks very well. So don't be scared off by if you're not familiar with these things. But Dr. Parker, can you give us a little bit about yourself? How'd you get into education, and what's your background?
Okay, so I'll tell you how I came to the book.
Sure.
Right? So I was writing my dissertation at Yale, for the PhD in anthropology and African American studies. And let me back up. I was thinking about what I should write about, right? And I've always had this fascination with Sartre and existentialism and specifically his brand of existential psychoanalysis, right? And so I knew that I wanted to do something on Sartre. And then at the same time, I was doing a lot of tutoring and teaching in New York City. Okay, I was writing the dissertation off-site, right? I was doing a lot of teaching and tutoring in New York City at the Harlem Children's Zone, which is a charter school based in Harlem. I was also doing private tutoring in very affluent areas for the SAT and ACT, ISEU, in on the Upper East Side, Greenwich, Connecticut, you know, different places in the Northeast. And observing classrooms, being in classrooms, it made me reflect back to when I was in school. And I was thinking, oh my God, I've always hated school. I've always hated school because it seemed like something completely unnatural to me. I don't know, it always felt that way. It's like, you know, you go to this place, this building, and everybody has to go to this building for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then when you're not in the building, you're preparing to go back to the building, doing homework, right? And then you wake up, and then you do it all over again. And then you do that, maybe from the age of 5 to 18, and then, so you're preparing to start your life, right? And then, after 18, you go to college, 4 years. You're 22 years old, okay? You spent those 4 years preparing to live life. And then you go to graduate school, continuing to prepare to live life, right? So I'm thinking, oh my God, this is like 25 or 30 years of your life that you're preparing to live your life. You know, it presented a very kind of tangled existential riddle for me. And so I was having all of these kind of conniptions and flashbacks working with students and being in schools. And then I thought to myself, I wonder if some of these students' experiences of the school environment were similar to my own. You know, if they felt it was somehow unnatural to be there, and then if so, why? And so I started thinking about kind of like the charter school situation and how it's enmeshed in this network of funders and well-wishers, you know, people who are kind of invested in these low-income students succeeding and thriving. And then I thought, what about the kids who don't have the benefit of being enmeshed in this network, right? You know, what about kids in a failing school, right, who are in many ways off the grid, okay? And so I'm thinking about this kind of this general experience of education that could appear, I don't know, to the human spirit as being somehow unnatural, and then compounded with that, being in a situation in which things are severely underfunded, maybe the building is run down, you know, you're kind of forgotten in many ways by the larger society. And I was like, well, I wonder what these kids are experiencing too, right? And I knew that the approach that I had to take would have to be somehow psychoanalytic. And because it posed such an interesting riddle of being and and who we are and who we become as human beings from being in certain experiences, I knew that I wanted to kind of cross-reference that experience and that research that it sought. Mm-hmm. So that was the birth of the dissertation.
Sure.
And then after the dissertation, I said, you know what, I think more people need to think about these issues. So I revised the book or revised the dissertation, and that's what became the published work in 2015.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think every PhD student is thinking like, oh, can this become a book one day? So that's great. That's fantastic that came out of this. One of the things that you talk about is this idea of datafication. And that's a theme that pops up in the first chapter, and then I think you talk about it later in the recommendations. And that was sort of coming from the Harlem Children's Zone, and I think it helped shape maybe what you didn't think sort of education should be. Can you kind of talk about why that maybe inspired you and that experience that helped set you up to sort of think about when you went off to the second school or when you went off to the academy, I think, as you dub it in the book?
Okay. Yes. So when I was at Harlem Children's Zone, we had to do what were called pullouts, right? So if a kid was in danger or was in danger of failing or had gotten a substandard score on the state examination the previous year in PLA or math, then they would have to do pullouts. So what would happen is you would go to the kid's activity after school, say it was basketball or cheerleading, you know, things kids really want to do. And you would say, hey, you have to come with me and get tutored for an hour. Mm. And these kids were so resistant. They used to run and hide. You know, you got yelled at.
Right.
You know, you could see tutors all the time kind of chasing kids down the hall. But it was all to help them succeed on the ELA and the math tests, right? And so ultimately, I think that, you know, when you're talking about expanding students' possibilities in life, right, and if you're talking about students who have not kind of had opportunities for, you know, a type of focused academic attention, you know, I think that type of one-on-one attention is necessary. So, I mean, in the long run, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to use the kind of ends justifies the means type of logic, but in the long run, it was a great thing for the Harlem Children's Zone, because I run into those kids today and they're like totally different people. They're
right.
In college, you know, their outlook on life is so optimistic, and you know, it's just so inspiring to know that I was a part of that. But I couldn't help but, you know, to go back to this theme of unnaturalness and, you know, thinking, oh my God, these kids have to get tutored, you know, 2 to 3 hours a week, every single week. I was like, oh, you know, it's probably a bad experience for them. But then when I went into the failing school, it was a situation that was way more excessive, right? Because the school was failing, students were required to take something like 10 periods of ELA and 10 periods of math per week. You know, it was very focused on those subjects, and it was very much geared toward taking this test, you know, at the end of the year. And they were all trapped in this cycle, you know. So you had students who were being forced to take these tests, and given that, you know, the curriculum was designed around the tests, well, you can imagine that the curriculum is not inspiring at all, right? You know, real learning, you know, is not really taking place. And then the teachers who were stuck teaching these things in uninspiring ways, like it would be very difficult for them to bring to life, you know, this test, model test that kids were taking. So it was just a very kind of miserable environment for everyone, you know, for the teachers, the students. And so the word that kind of came to me was this datafication, theologism. Because essentially, you know, what these kids were to the school administrators, to the larger district, just pieces of data, you know? Are you a one? Are you a two, a three, or a four on this test? You know, that was the focus. You know, what is your score and what is your grade?
Right.
And it got to the point where the identity of the student tended to be kind of condensed into this score or this grade. Mm. You know, so essentially it became synonymous with their identity, you know, at least how they function in the school and in the larger construct of the district. And so that's, you know, kind of how that term came about.
Sure, sure. Well, then I think it jumps well into, I think you cover high stakes testing, but especially No Child Left Behind and sort of the racial hierarchy behind some of these high stakes testing that came about with it. Can you kind of maybe talk about that or give us a little why that's important and especially maybe important to this school, and then maybe we can jump into some of the school what you know, what the school looked like and who the students are, things like that.
Okay, yeah. So as I said before, you know, the high stakes testing, the life of the school essentially depended on the test, right? Whether the school was going to survive into the next year and the subsequent years was dependent on how the kids did on the test, mm-hmm. right? And so, of course, if you're receiving, you know, money and all kinds of support for ensuring that kids do well on a test, well, the whole focus of education is going to be the test, right? So that created the environment. Oh, I heard a beep. Is everything okay? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're good. Yep.
Okay. So it created, you know, this environment. It created the environment in which there was a mandate to have 10 periods of ELA mm-hmm. and 10 periods of math, you know, every single week.
Right.
So the educational experience itself was compromised by kind of like the trickle-down effect of No Child Left Behind kind of policies and how those were adopted by the state and then the school district, and it was even more kind of sinister for these low-performing schools.
Mm-hmm.
But what was even more interesting, you know, what I found in my research was that let's say, you know, so the school that I was in was failing and it was going to be closed in 2 years. Okay? So this is what happens. When a school is slated to close, they go through a process of what's called phasing out. Right? So it's, at first, it's 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. In the subsequent year, the 6th grade is phased out, and then it's going to be 7th and 8th grade. And then for the subsequent year, the 7th grade is phased out, and then it's going to be the 8th grade. And then the following year, the school doesn't exist.
Wow.
Well, while a school is phasing out, there's a school that's phasing in.
Mm.
That school, many times, is either a franchise, you know, of a high-performing kind of school franchise, or it could be a charter school, or some vision of loveliness that's sold to all of us, that's going to be the savior of this neighborhood, right? But what happens with the school that's phasing out, money is taken out of that school and reinvested into the school that's phasing in.
Mm.
So it's very much, if anyone is familiar with Judeo-Christian theology, you know, it feels very much like a rapture situation. You know, people fear that, when Christ returns, right, then he's going to take his elect, and then, you know, the ones who are sinners, they're going to have to remain behind in this, you know, very tormenting situation and just spend for themselves until they're finally kind of extinguished,
mm.
right? And that's what it felt like in the school. Like, all the resources were taken out. Like, oh my God, you know, I was miserable as a student growing up, you know, because I thought that the school environment was unnatural. But this is like beyond unnatural. It's unnatural. It's cruel. It's. I just couldn't believe that human beings, so young and impressionable, were forced to live inside of these conditions for 8 hours of the day, 5 days a week, for 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the big question in the book is, when you are living, because it is a part of life, when you are living inside of that situation, it doesn't just compromise your prospects for life it doesn't just cause you to have these momentary, experiences of displeasure. It's going to create a certain type of human being. You're going to be fundamentally transformed at your core by being inside of this experience. And so what I wanted to do was see that transformation occurring on the ground. What are the factors that are leading to this transformation? How is it happening? Who are all the players involved?
Right. And so this is an ethnographic study. You're embedded in the school for, I think, nine months, I believe. Can you kind of talk about that process? And maybe, I think you mentioned Mr. Wheeler in the book. So he's a teacher. Who's that? What's his importance? And then also the students. Can you give us a sense of who these students are?
Yeah. So, I was pretty much a fly on the wall, for 9 months. Mr. Wheeler is a fellow educator and friend of mine. That's a pseudonym, by the way.
Sure.
I wish I, there were so many things that, about him that were so great. But, in order to protect the identity of the students and the school and everyone involved, I have to use pseudonyms and so forth. But I would love to just be able to blast to the world and sing the praises of Mr. Wheeler.
Sure.
Because he was such an amazing educator. But anyway, so Mr. Wheeler allowed me to sit inside of his classroom. And that gave me access to the school. So through him, I got consent to kind of go throughout different classrooms in the school, sit inside different classrooms and see what was happening day to day. I got to interview the students. I got to work with some of the students because, one of my passions, of course, is helping just helping human beings thrive in life. And, of course, education is a part of that. So, I got an opportunity to tutor some of the students, and work with them and mentor them on certain levels. But I got a lot of robust data, about what was kind of occurring in these situations. Mr. Wheeler was a big foil to it all. Everything that every educational scholar has said that an educator should be, Mr. Wheeler was that and more. I mean, he just went to bat for his students. He understood the importance of the aesthetic environment, and he made sure that, even though the school was under-resourced and the general environment was very dilapidated, that his classroom was an oasis. He wrote grants for his students. He, got all this great equipment. So he was a grand foil to it all. But what I saw from day to day, so the building itself was, it was one of those situations where it was kind of four schools in one.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular school was like on the fifth or sixth floor or something. So, there are definitely health advantages to going to this school. You have to climb those steps every day. But, it's not a pleasant journey. And then when you get to the top, you enter the gym, and it's like this grand kind of illustration of colorlessness, right? Totally the opposite of what you would expect a child's recreational environment should be, right? You go through the gym, you go into the school, there's no artwork on the walls, there's no paint, there's no library, the halls are very narrow. Many of the teachers had this kind of worn, depressed look on their faces. And you got the impression that they were more afraid of the students. So there was very little kind of authentic engagement, that was occurring between the students and the teachers. It's not an environment that I would want to work in. Undoubtedly, the teachers were affected, even by the physical landscape of the space, and then, the students even more so. I hope I answered of your question.
Yeah, no, that was fantastic. But how about the students, though? They're mostly coming from low-income families, as I think classified by Title I or reduced and free lunch, I think is the classification. I think you said Black and Latino, most of the population as well. Can you talk about maybe some of your interactions with the students?
Yeah, so the students were predominantly low-income, Black and Latino, and this is actually part of the provision of Title I, right, that this particular population has to be, so the goal of the No Child Left Behind legislation and the Title I part of that was to kind of ensure that these disadvantaged populations were kind of on task for ELA and math to reach proficiency, you know, ideally by 2014. And so given that that was the provision, you had the 10 periods of ELA, 10 periods of math in this particular school. You know, that had a lot to do with the general environment. But the students, some of them were diagnosed as having learning disabilities, you know, as well. Some of them had gang affiliations. Some of them had already interfaced with the criminal justice system. But interestingly, you know, I think the big lesson out of all this, you know, going back to the issue of datification, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if a student is a 1 or a 4 or is Black or not Black, has a criminal record or not a criminal record. When I would interface with these students, what I saw was big ambitions. I saw human beings. I saw optimism. I saw innocence. Everything that you would expect to find in a child or a human being were present in these students. And so if a teacher kind of got caught up in kind of the culturally defined choreography of the student, the way he or she was acting or speaking, or, you know, got caught up in the fact this student had already interfaced with the criminal justice system, right, then there were already these kind of barriers for meaningful exchange, right? But the meaningful exchange was completely possible, you know, as demonstrated in my interactions with the students and Mr. Wheeler's interactions with the students. And, you know, to, you know, use a term that's not really kind of scientifically acceptable or quantifiable, you know, if you loved and cared for these students, then you had great results. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I saw in the school. If you didn't let all of these other labels become a barrier to your interaction, you know, with the students, then you had great results.
Sure. So, yeah. And I guess just keep moving forward with the book. One of the other insights that you had was from the state English language, the Department of Education trying to close down. You sat in on some of the meetings with the administrators. Can you maybe talk about what you saw there? Because that was sort of, I think, the future of this school. It was about to be going through the same process, I believe.
So. Yeah. So I got an opportunity to sit in on some school closing meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there was another school in a similar in the same area that was slated to close. Right. But the parents were trying to fight to keep the school open. Right. And ultimately, they won. They won, you know, it was a big victory. You know, they got some elected officials involved. You know, they won. But some of the arguments that the parents were giving were very interesting. And this is why ethnographic study is so important, to just listen to people and speak to people and just watch and see what's happening on the ground. The running theme was that we've been asking for help for years. You know, we've been trying to get money pumped into arts programs and after-school tutoring programs for years. You know, this is what we have done, and it hasn't happened, right? And so now that the kids are failing, now you want to close the school, right? And the kids and the parents also did not think that it was a coincidence that as the school was was phasing out or threatening to phase out, the neighborhood itself was gentrifying. You know? So you have this emergent gentry, you know, in the area. And of course, the emergent gentry is going to want a good school for their kids. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to, and they're not going to want to ship them off across town because it's all about convenience. People pay for convenience, right? And so as one school is phasing out that's supposedly failing, you know, you have this great school that's phasing in, the neighborhood is gentrifying, and so the parents saw this, or they saw the motive of kind of Xing out the school as being something much more insidious than just, oh, the school is failing, we need to help the community by bringing in another school. Essentially, they thought it was more, well, we're going to get this school out so we can get a better school in to accommodate the wealthier population that's moving into the area. Mm-hmm. And some of their insights proved very credible, you know, when looking at the research and looking at the patterns and how similar phenomenon was happening all over the country, you know, in urban areas. So sure.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be definitely, I think, very interesting to see some of those notes that you took or some of the research that you compiled that together. But we're kind of moving closer to the end of the interview, and you have some recommendations in the back of the book, and maybe don't give away everything, but if we could, maybe some of your thoughts on you know, I guess, fixes or changes that you see from your research and experience.
A lot of it comes down to the, I'm not going to say that a lot of it comes down to the evaluation process, but evaluation is a big part of it, how these schools are evaluated. It has to be totally different, right? I mean, we all know that, let me back up a bit.
Sure.
So, of course, the educational experience itself has to be different, right? The environment has to be inspiring. Aesthetically, you know, the teachers, you know, who are involved, you know, how the curriculum is administered. But when it comes down to the evaluation and how you make the determination whether or not this is a good school, a bad school, whether the school deserves to be closed or open or phased out, well, you have to look at a lot more criteria. You know, you can't just look at the numbers. You have to look at the total environment, right? And in addition to that, you cannot ignore how history and culture kind of plays into these discussions. You know, so for instance, one thing that's documented in the book was the fact that in some classrooms, there are many kids who were below, you know, like threshold of literacy. Right? You know, they just were not reading on grade level. And the teachers would tell me, well, you know, I used to give them challenging work, but they couldn't handle it. And so I, you know, I decided to make it easier. Right? This is what the teachers would be telling me. And then the students would tell me, independent, right? They had no idea about the conversation that I had with the teachers. They would tell me, you know, the teacher, she just gives us all this easy baby work, and it's not going to get us anywhere. And I hate her for it. So insulting. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
You know, so you see he's just dumbing down curriculum. But what's happening is that you're sending tacit messages to the students. You're saying, in dumbing down this curriculum, you are not intellectually capable. You are not... And this came out in some other places in the book. Your culture is inferior. You should act differently. All of these are messages that are being transmitted to the students. They're internalizing it. They're experiencing this 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, three years of their lives. It's transforming who they are, right, as people. Right? And so if you talk about an appropriate evaluation process, you have to look at those types of things, right? You have to have a more kind of ethnographically informed evaluation that's looking at kind of how the minds the hearts and the spirits of the children are being transformed by the messages that they're hearing and the environment that they're experiencing every day. Yeah. And if you don't look at that as a part of a process of reform, then it's going to fail.
Fantastic.
Yeah, sure. I know. We
can't get into everything.
Right. That's okay. That's just to, you know, get the beak wet, and then, you know, people can go and really check out the details within the book. So we're kind of coming up to the final question. So do you have any last words on the book? And usually the final question we also have on the New Books Network is, what are you up to next? Like, what's the next project that you have?
Okay. So any final words on the book? I just think that, I think it's a very, of course I wrote it, so I'm going to think good things about it, but I think it's a very enlightening study, for anyone who is concerned with policy reform, evaluation. It has a lot of, I feel that it's something that's needed because, you know, we say all the time, oh, the schools are failing and things are really bad. But the book, it's an insider expose of what's really happening on the ground every day with these students. Right. And it privileges the voices of the students, which sometimes you don't get in educational studies. Like, we get to hear exactly what the kids are saying, what they feel about their teachers. We get to hear what the teachers are saying. So I think it's a very enlightening study for educators as well. So if you're looking to sort of improve your practice or strategize better about ways to deal with these, quote, disadvantaged populations. So sure. Those are my final words on the book.
Sure.
In terms of what I'm up to next, so I started a company 2 years ago, Parker Academics. So we do tutoring and even test preparation, for populations all over New York City and beyond. So that's one thing that's absorbing a lot of my time. In terms of academic study, you know, it's interesting. My approach to doing intellectual work has always been to just let the faucet run recklessly on curiosity. So I just kind of read and inquire about the things that I'm interested in and just see where it takes me, you know. And it was like that with Sartre and No Child Left Behind, too, you know, because I was reading a lot of Sartre. I was even reading a lot of Bertrand Russell, mathematical philosophy, and a lot of the symbolic anthropologists and Freud and some folks. So, you know, it just all came together in that package. But lately, I've been reading a lot of theoretical physics. Wow. So I'm fascinated with, and it probably goes back to just, you know, this whole feeling of school as being unnatural in the state that it's in. But I'm very interested in these kind of larger kind of ways of thinking that form the outer limits of who we think we are or what we can imagine reality to be. You know, when I think about the theoretical physicists, you know, they proposed all of these things about reality and the way that it's constructed. So I've been fascinated by string theory and its evolution into M theory. And in addition to that, I've been reading a lot of stuff on neuroscience, you know, how the brain is wired and all that stuff. So I'm curious myself to see where all of that is going to lead me in terms of papers and books and...
Sure.
I'm not a physicist, and I'm not a mathematician, but I love the subjects, and I just I want to see where it takes me. So sure. I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, we'll look forward to hopefully merging those two somehow with your passion in education. So that's great. We've come to the end of the interview, and I thank everyone for joining us today. And I suggest you to go check out Sartre and No Child Left Behind, an existential psychoanalytic anthropology of urban schooling. And this is from Dr. Darian Parker. And thank you for joining me today. And to everyone out there, I hope you learned something.